We'll call to order the home care workforce shortage working group. First off, I want to thank everyone that was able to come in today. I know the weather posed a slight challenge, and so I want to thank folks that were able to make it in. Due to the weather, Representative Schultz emailed my office this morning and said that she was unable to come down from Duluth, which I fully understand, and it's one of those things. I know if we would have canceled the meeting, the snow would not have come. And then I also want to take just a brief moment to the rest of the working group and apologize for the difficulties with the schedule and getting this meeting scheduled following our first meeting of the working group. There was concerns with the House and Senate leadership around continued funding, and so all committees and working groups were kind of paused while that portion was figured out. And I can say with full confidence, it has been not figured out. But we push ahead, and there does appear to be the funding process in place to allow the legislature to meet our financial obligations in moving forward for the time being. And so we thought it was important for work groups such as this that were supposed to meet during the interim to resume operations. So we've called the meeting to order. I'll now have our CLA call the roll.
Do we have a Diane Benjamin?
Yes.
Sue Kissel?
Yes.
Olivia Anderson? Over there. Heidi Hamilton, also in the crowd. Melissa Finnegan is in the crowd. Nikitha is in the crowd. Do we have Diane? I'm so sorry for butchering any names, by the way.
Yes.
All right, thank you. Darielle Dannon. Oriane Cassette. Again, thank you. Susan Brower is here. John Tolofsen?
Yes.
Perfect. Tara Erickson is here. Sherry Miller is here. Shirley Brecken, also here. Marilyn Krasowski, not here, all right. Joan Vaughn is here. Amy Nelson?
Not here.
Not here. Kathy Messerly?
Judy Heedle is here from the Minnesota Home Care Association.
All right. Kevin Goodnow also said he would not be here. Ani Simons? No. Deb Tower? Sandy Gerdes? And then is there anybody else I missed? Yes.
Stacy Vogel.
How do you spell that?
V-O-G.
E-L-E. Appointed family. All right. Good job.
All right. Thank you, Rachel. Up next on our agenda, we have a presentation by our state demographer, Susan Brower.
Good afternoon. My name is Susan Brower. I work in the Department of Administration, and I'm Minnesota State Demographer. I've been asked just to give a brief overview of the labor force situation in Minnesota and the projections that we've made to give a general sense of the larger picture, the big picture going forward with respect to this working group's work. And so I will do that briefly. We've made some projections about how the labor force will grow in the future, and what we're seeing is that for the state overall, we expect that there will be continued growth, but that it will be very slow growth in the future. So just to give you a sense of what it's looked like in the past, in the 1990s, it was the labor force, this is just the number of people who were working or looking for work, who are age 16 and above. There were 54,000 additional people each year added to Minnesota's workforce over the course of the 1990s, or 540,000 over that whole decade. And you can see in the 2000s that number began to drop off to about 34,000 each year on average. It's dropped off again in the 2010s, the first part of this decade, and we expect going forward that there will be almost no growth in the number of workers in Minnesota. This is occurring as the large baby boom generation is moving into retirement. There's a large generation of millennials who are moving in to take the place of the baby boomers, but it's not big enough to both replace the baby boomers and keep up the same level of growth that we've seen in the past. These are the numbers rather than showing you the change, and what I draw your attention to is the line on the bottom, that kind of light blue line, age 65 plus. The number of older adults who are over the age of 65 will go from about 680,000 in 2010 to about 1.3 million in 2030. So there'll be pressure on the amount of health care services that are needed just because of that population shift. At the very same time that that's happening, there's almost no growth, as you can see from the green line, in the number of working age folks, that number stays almost the same, even though you have this big increase of people who will be requiring care and consuming more health care services. Part of what's happening, part of the picture for Minnesota, is that we have had ongoing losses in terms of migration, that we've had net losses of people moving to other states for many, many years. Since 2002, we've seen a loss of people moving out to other states, more people moving away than were moving here. We have fully compensated that for those losses in terms of our international migration. That's the blue bar on this chart here. The green bars are showing domestic migration. But you can see that the workforce situation hasn't, at least in recent years, in the last 15 years or so, been helped too much by the domestic situation, by the fact that we've lost people. What we've seen in the very most recent data point that was just released is we actually saw positive net migration, domestic migration, for the first time in about 15 years. And so that is a good sign. We expect that there is some, there may be some turnaround because of the need for workers, but we still project, even with increased migration, that we'll see very little growth in the working age population going forward.
Any breakdown of the age demographics in that domestic net increase? Is there any idea? Are we gaining working age people domestically, or is this retire? Who wants to retire to Minnesota when it's snowing? But the idea here is, what is the makeup of that net increase?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have it for the net, so I can't tell you where the net gains are from this data source, but when I've looked at it from another data source, the net gains are occurring in the working ages. Most of the people who move are in their late teen years or early 20s. That's where we tend to lose people. And I haven't been able to look specifically to see if this turnaround has been led by any one particular group, because those data aren't out yet. But generally, what's driving migration trends are the movement of young people, young adults, and not the older population. DEED does a job vacancies survey. And I think one of the striking things that you'll see, kind of the big picture pieces of the workforce puzzle, is that in recent years we've seen they've collected data that have shown that the number of job vacancies has met or recently exceeded the number of people who are working looking for work in the state. And that's not at all the case during the recession. What was the case during the recession, of course, it wasn't the case before the recession. And so this is a unique point in our history where there's a very, very tight labor market. And given what we have for projections, we would expect, of the labor force side of things, we would expect that this tight labor market would remain as long as our economy is growing and doing well. So under these conditions, there's increase in competition for workers. There's upward pressure on wages. Employers have a hard time finding folks, and they may have positions that they're just not able to fill. Job seekers and switchers can be picky. They're sought after. And so this is the situation under which you will be solving the workforce shortages, that these are the conditions that we expect will continue into the future, that there will be upward pressure on those wages and that it will remain into the foreseeable future, assuming that the economy continues to do well and continues to grow. Now, so far I've been talking about the state overall. I just want to show you a couple of slides to show you that the picture is quite different if you look around the state. In Greater Minnesota in particular, the number of people who are retired relative to the number of people who are working is much higher, and that's shown by the very darkest areas of this map. You can see in the northern part of the state and the southwestern part of the state where those counties are dark, they have a much higher ratio of older adults to working age people. And so you would expect in those areas that the situation would be particularly tough to find health care workers because the demand would be growing due to the older ages, but the supply of workers wouldn't necessarily be there. We've looked at some workforce projections around the state, and I showed you the numbers overall, what we expect for changes going ahead in the number of workers in the state. But when we've looked at it county by county and built that up into regional levels, we really expect most of the growth will be right in the metropolitan area, and that most of the other areas of the state will actually experience small declines in the number of workers that they have. So this exacerbates some of the situations, particularly in the area of healthcare, indirect care, in Greater Minnesota, as you're aware, but we would expect that this situation would continue to progress into the next 5 to 10 to 15 years. So you have your work cut out. But this is the picture that I can see. This is the context under which this is unfolding.
Well, after that rosy picture...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you going to, is this time to, do we get to pick Ms. Bauer's brain for a while? Is this?
Absolutely.
I got 35 minutes of questions, so are you okay with that?
How to make friends and influence others.
I got to love it. Senator Ralph would say we're going to go down the rabbit hole a little bit here. On slide 5, when you look at the number of unemployed, you had... presented a study that showed, and if I get these demographics wrong, please correct me, and then because I really wanted to highlight the impact that demographic shift is going to have on health and human services in the state. Age 45 to 64 unemployed. Do you remember that graph when you were showing 1/3 of the unemployed folks that are African American have 31% of them have a disability? Good, you're shaking your head, so I'm getting this right. And the other thing that I remember vividly from that presentation was 34%, take the same age range, 45 to 64, so just getting ready to get the silver tsunami, 34% of those that are unemployed that are Hmong have a disability. So there's this waiting need that's going to be sitting out there. Can you kind of give us a projection or talk about how, because you only spent a few minutes on that slide, and there was only two of us that really saw that and said, aha, there's something that we need to do, and I believe we brought the issue of where's Health and Human Services, and I'm glad Heidi Hamilton is here because it's the same question about what options are going to exist, especially when it comes to workforce shortage. So can you kind of go a little bit deeper on that and correct me if I'm wrong on those numbers, but really talk about what the potential impact is?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but I know what you're referring to. I know which report to point you toward and others towards, and I'd be happy to follow up with that report and just describe the general picture. I do have that in my head. I just don't have the exact numbers.
I have the ability to visually take a picture of something. My numbers are dead on, by the way. So.
Love that. So this is a report called The Economic Status of Minnesotans, and we looked specifically at the groups that were important, that were large in size in Minnesota, so that we looked at Hmong Minnesotans separately from Somali Minnesotans, separately from African U.S.-born African American. This report is on our website. And what we found with respect to disability is large shares of particularly populations of color who had been in the U.S. for some time, having a much higher than one would expect share of people with disabilities. Relative to the population overall of Minnesota, these are still relatively small numbers of folks, but it's disproportionate given the what you would expect. So it was, I know it's close to a third to a half for those two communities that you mentioned. What produces those disabilities, you know, the socioeconomic conditions certainly produce long-term disabilities, sometimes health disabilities, and so we see some of that, but I think it's something that I haven't seen folks fully address yet, just what unpacking that. And I really only have that high-level number to say this is disproportionate. We're seeing more disabilities among some populations.
So let me ask as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, if I could, on that. Those are some really intriguing numbers there. And when you look at the whole state as the aging population is, and my assumption then, and I don't know if you can uncover that one, that it, out in rural Minnesota, that disproportionality is going to be even larger due to the fact that there's less providers. Is that a current assumption? Is that a correct assumption to make?
I would expect, and I think this is already being felt, that you would see in greater Minnesota a greater need for workers, just because you've had the loss of workers over time. You have that older population, and you would have that great need for care and not the middle-aged to younger workforce supporting it. And what I understand is happening, especially with some of the jobs that are lower skilled, that increased competition means that people are moving into other types of jobs that are paying more. And so I think that's part of the bigger picture, that piece of competition, but also who's living where and what's the ratio of older folks to younger.
Thank you. Those are the two points I really wanted to get stressed out and for public record. And Mr. Chair, the impact on that workforce, especially if you're talking about now these are potentially people on hourly waiver services, and I don't have it in front of me, but the pay scale for the individuals are on the DWRS system, on the rate methodology and the reimbursement side, but the only way they get paid is when we give them more money to be paid. So once again, there's a highlighted gap there that I think has been exposed that we really need to take a deeper look at and see what that long-term impact is going to be. And thank you for those. And I think people would benefit from that part of the study that you did, and I appreciate that. And by the way, yeah, my numbers are right. I remember. I'm telling you.
I'm happy.
I don't know why I remember that stuff, Nick, but anyway, thank you. Yep. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for our state demographer? Thank you so much for the presentation. And I think it does do a nice job of setting the stage for the scope of some of the challenges that we face across the state in trying to staff facilities. All right, up next we have a series of presentations from the Department of Economic Employment Development, Department of Human Services, and the Minnesota Department of Health. All right. When you're ready, please introduce yourself to the committee and please begin.
Senator Ralph and Representative Zerwas, my name is Oriane Casale. I'm with the Labor Market Information Office at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I've been asked to present on the labor market information that we have available for Minnesota's RN, registered nurse, and licensed practical nurse. Workforce with a focus on the home health care industry. This slide provides employment and wage data for RNs and LPNs by specific industry of employment. So you'll see that within ambulatory health services, home health care services has 3,200 RNs, 1,726 LPNs, and you'll see their wages there in the right-hand column. Hospitals, nursing, and residential care are all, so together, ambulatory care, hospitals, and nursing and residential care make up healthcare. You'll also see employment services at the bottom there, which is not part of healthcare, but choice program RNs and LPNs are paid through intermediary services companies, but actually hired directly by employers, by the people who need their services. So the largest group of RNs work for hospitals, which also pay the highest wages. Home health care industry pays about the same as nursing and residential care, about $10 less per hour than hospitals. Data from our 2012 hiring difficulty survey, which is really old now, indicates that nursing and residential care and home health care industries have a much more difficult time filling RN vacancies than hospitals because the wages are low, and also because RNs view these settings as having fewer opportunities for advancement. The other obvious issue is that home health care requires people to drive from client to client, and that is also considered less desirable by many RNs. Hospitals are more likely to hire at the four-year degree level, while nursing homes tend to hire at the two-year degree level, and that can explain some of the wage difference that you're seeing in this table. The rest of the data that I have can't be disaggregated by home health care services industry, so this is for all RNs, no matter where they work, although the vast majority work in healthcare. The first bullet point there, registered nurse is an extremely high demand occupation, ranking second out of all occupations based on our occupations in demand data. And I guess the point I want to make about this bullet is that being a high-demand occupation doesn't necessarily mean this is a shortage occupation. There's a huge supply of RNs, and so it's basically where that supply and that demand diverge, and we just don't have very good data on that, so I can't really speak to the shortage issue. But what I can say is in a very tight labor market, wages make a huge difference in terms of being able to recruit. Under very different labor market conditions, again, the 2012 survey showed that employers hiring production, engineering, and IT occupations had more difficulty finding qualified workers than those hiring for RN positions. However, within industries that do hire RNs, the nursing and residential care and the home health care industries were having the most difficulty finding these qualified individuals. So it's unclear if these conditions remain the same today. Obviously, the second set of conditions, that the lower wage industries are having a harder time hiring these positions, is clearly still true. So RNs earn a median wage of $36.25 an hour. They're projected to grow, the occupation is projected to grow at a rate of 11.8% over the 10-year period ending in 2024. The number of RN vacancies increased 38% over the year, from 2006 second quarter, 2007 second quarter, and that compares to 26% for vacancies across the board. And the wage offers for RNs increased 3.5% over the year, compared to 2.8% for all vacancies.
Can I ask you a question about the 6,700, the increase of 6,700 nurses in that 10-year span? Is that taking the total amount of nursing positions we'll need to fill in the state, or is that saying that so many are going to retire?
No, that does not include people leaving the profession. So that is just due to growth in the occupation. So just additional jobs that we've never seen before.
And do we know what that 6,700 over a decade looks like if we factor in retirements?
I believe it's closer to 21,000. Do I have that number somewhere? I don't think I have that number with me, but I could certainly get it to you.
All right. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. Oh, we have some questions. Go ahead.
My name is Judy Giel, and I'm with the Minnesota Home Care Association. One thing I know, there's a discrepancy when we collect data. Home health is a federal program, and that's one category of employer. There's also home care, which is funded by the state. And could you go back to the first slide that you presented to help me know where those workers might be reflected?
So my understanding is that because of, we're using the North American Industrial Classification System, NAICS, which is a three-country industrial classification system, so it's very broad. It doesn't necessarily break industries down by funding streams, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So these industries are based on what people do or what they produce. And so in this case, this industry is grouping together everyone who provides home care, home health care services. So I have to believe that it includes both of those groups.
Okay.
Yeah. Ms. Erickson, go ahead.
Tara Erickson with the LPN Association. So that was going to be my question, is I was wondering, like, about median wage. Is that statewide average? Because obviously metro wages are...
It's statewide median, 50th percentile.
Okay.
Yep.
And then, you know, when I was looking at, I mean, obviously we know that home health obviously pays differently than, like, hospitals. But I think you just said that we're not breaking that down by how it's reimbursed. So, I mean, like, a lot of this is due to a Medicaid reimbursement, and when you have Medicaid reimbursements not paying that much, then those wages are going to have to, you know, attribute to what they're, okay.
The other thing is you do find home health care providing RNs in hospitals, and they would be in the hospital industry. And so we're not breaking them out as a separate occupation. We're breaking them out only based on the industry of the employer.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
So my last slide is licensed practical nurses. Licensed practical nurse is also a high-demand occupation, ranking 15th out of all occupations. LPNs earn a median wage of $21.34 per hour. LPN is projected to grow by 2,057 jobs, or 11.3%. It's just a smaller occupation. The number of LPN vacancies increased 10% over the year to 1,700 vacancies. And the wage offer actually dropped by 3% over the year to $19.69 per hour.
Again, I assume that you are talking then just pure growth rather than attrition and retirement.
That's correct.
Okay.
And to that end, do you have numbers for to replace existing?
I certainly can get those to you.
Okay.
One last question. Any indication of what created this drop in wages? That's pretty dramatic.
I think LPNs are more tied to Medicaid reimbursement, and so and just where they're at, and when that isn't, you know, I mean, I would assume that that would be part of it.
I don't know specifically. When we see these kind of fluctuations in wage offers, a lot of times it's being driven by which industries are doing the hiring. In this case, it could potentially be that if the home health care industry and the nursing home industry are having a harder time hiring LPNs, they may have the lion's share of the vacancies out there right now. And that's driving down the wage offer because they can only offer so much for those openings. So it could be an industry mix, and it could be what we're really seeing right now, and I think Susan spoke to this too, is that jobs at the low end across the board at the lower wage end are beginning to pile up in the economy because employers just can't find people to fill these jobs. And so that is having a bit of an impact on wages. We're seeing wage offers increase in those occupations, but overall we're not seeing big wage increases in all jobs combined because these low-wage job vacancies are piling up, if that makes sense.
I guess just to follow that, I'm not quite sure. You're saying that because there are so many jobs that
vacancies
that wages are dropping?
Well, because the vacancies that are beginning to build up in the economy that employers are having a very hard time and not filling are the lower wage vacancies. So the lower wage occupations are where we're seeing greater increases in the number of vacancies, right? So these are the lower wage occupations, and those vacancies are beginning to build up over time, and so that's dragging down the overall median vacancy wage offer for vacancies.
But not specific to
LPNs, no. Well, not necessarily specific to LPNs.
So you're talking about the published offer rather than the amount that is actually being paid?
Yes.
So do we have any numbers on what is actually being paid?
So this first slide is all existing jobs in the economy. So these are what are actually being paid. It's only these last bullets on these last two pages that are wage offers.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Hoffman.
So if what Ms. Erickson is saying, this causes another friction point along with the DWRS issue and the fact that people get paid according to, you know, the wages that we provide. If Medicaid, if that is a true... Tara, if we could get some more information on that, that'll even have another large impact on the workforce, because the scary thing is if we block grant the state of Minnesota, because we're traditionally been above and beyond anybody else. Does anybody have those numbers as far as if that is a true assumption Because if that indeed is tied to the Medicaid reimbursement, if there is some correlation between those two, then there's going to be another gap that I think is going to exist for us within the workforce, especially when it comes to our aging adults, especially those that are going to have special health care needs, like the demographer was showing. So,
Senator Hoffman,
yeah.
Obviously, like, I was just more, like, I know where my members work, and, you know, they are in group homes. They are in nursing homes.
Yeah, yeah.
Many, like, they're going to be more tied to, you know, Medicaid reimbursement just in where they are. So that was the only reason. I don't know if what I just said is true. I was just throwing out a question to see if you knew, but
yeah.
It would just make kind of, I guess, more sense as to where they work, that it would be tied to some type of pot of money, and in that case, it's Medicaid.
I think somebody should answer that for us. That's huge.
Yeah, no, that's huge.
Yeah.
I think, did you have a question?
I think mine was asked. I was wondering about the drop in wage offers and whether you had any data showing whether there was a shift in employment by industry, but you kind of answered that. I was also wondering if there's any data on the longer-term trend. So was the 3% drop in offers kind of a blip, or is there a longer analysis of it?
I can certainly put that together.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks. All right. Ms. Vogel?
My comment is just similar, that the RNs in the home care field, their salaries are very limited because of the Medicaid reimbursement rate. I mean, it's the same for RNs and LPNs. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right, I think we have Heidi Hamilton next. All right. Ms. Hamilton, when you're ready, begin.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Heidi Hamilton. I work for the Department of Human Services. I don't have a PowerPoint, but I will be walking through this handout. So the Department of Human Services manages the medical assistance program, and so the information that we've provided is related to home care nursing paid for through medical assistance. We do have information for other types of direct care service providers, but because of the purpose of this work group is focusing on home care nursing, that's what our information is related to. Just for some background, when a person is assessed for home care nursing, the needs and interventions a person needs are considered in determining what their home care rating is and whether they qualify for complex home care nursing. And then the amount of hours are authorized for an individual. When hours are authorized, it really is the maximum that a person could need, so that there's some flexibility in how their needs are being met. And through that, an agency could, even though if a person qualifies for complex nursing, they could use a combination of RN and LPN. So the information that we've provided, it's best to look at the final column, the grand total column, because of the flexibility that the agencies have in using the services. As I mentioned, the maximum numbers of hours are authorized. We have no way in our data to know why a person isn't using their maximum hours authorized. It could be that they've been hospitalized, or family members are providing the care instead of a RN or an LPN, or it could be workforce shortage, and we don't know that, and our data doesn't show that. So what I want to point out is in 2014, 15, 16, it's been fairly consistent between 73% and 75% of the authorized RN hours and LPN hours together are paid. There's no statistic significance between what was happening in 2014 and what's happening now. And as I mentioned, we have no way of knowing why that is. So we don't feel like our data proves or disproves whether there is a workforce shortage, although we do acknowledge that there is based on all the information we've heard today, information we hear from our providers and service recipients.
I guess I have a question. If we look back further than 2014, I don't know, how far back do you have data? Maybe we'll start there.
I'm not sure, Diane, do you know how far we have data on this?
We can check on that with our data people, but pretty far back in terms of record retention. So.
Yeah, because I guess one of the questions that, I mean, if the number's been hovering around that 75 to 74%, you know, 2016, 2015, 2014, if we go back to 1995, is the number going to be there? Or is it going to be, is that ratio going to be a little tighter? I guess is my question. I think most of the people that are concerned about this issue fully recognize the workforce shortage for home health care nursing within Minnesota, and we don't view it as a problem that started in 2014. And so I, for one, wouldn't expect that big of a change from the ratio from 2014 to 2016, but I would be really curious to say if we go back a decade further, and if we go back a decade before that, did it used to be 90% and then 85 and now 75? I think a more historical perspective might give the committee some, I think, really powerful information.
Sure, we can definitely do that.
Senator Hoffman, do you have something?
No, I'm thinking.
And?
Just a basic question. How is a unit defined here, an authorized unit?
I'm going to defer to Diane Benjamin on your committee.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? My data person is getting back to me.
How is a unit defined here?
A unit is defined as 15 minutes.
15 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
15 minutes.
And that's a billable increment, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. So that's why that's how they bill. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, John Tolleson with the nurses. Is there a difference in reimbursement rates for a complex LPN hour or unit versus an RN complex unit, or is it sort of one reimbursement rate that the home care provider can then determine how to divvy up?
I'm getting there.
They're different rates. It's about $7.44 per unit for an LPN complex and $10.44 for RN complex. About that. I might be a few pennies off, but.
So then when they're authorized for a patient, do they authorize X number of hours for LPN services and X number per patient for RN services? Or does the home care provider determine the split between hours?
Mr. Chair, and I forgot your name.
Mr. Tollefson.
Basically, the agency submits their plan of care through DHS's medical review agent, who reviews, as Heidi said, the complexity of the patient and the needs of the person, and then the medical review agent determines the home care rating, and we have a budgetary cap, and the agencies tend to submit an initial staffing plan between RN or LPN, depending on, you know, how they want to staff this person and how complex the person is. And then frequently, as Heidi said, agencies have flexibility to move staffing patterns throughout the year and do that frequently to manage to keep more hours in the home. Sometimes they'll purchase regular nursing instead of complex nursing because of the lower reimbursement rate, and they can put more hours in the home. So it just all depends on the situation.
Yes, please.
Joan Vaughn from the Professional Home Care Coalition. I apologize for my voice, Mr. Chair. It's also important to note that there's the complex and the regular reimbursement rates, and that the regular reimbursement rates are about $10 an hour less. So if I'm having a hard time getting an RN to work for $25 an hour, I'm really having a hard time getting them work for a lot less than that.
All right, Dan.
One more. Diane Roderick from the Health Department. So just following up on that, so if the complex rates are $10.44 for an RN, $7.44 for an LPN, and the regular rates are about $10 less than that per unit.
Per hour.
So the reimbursement rate for a complex RN is $10 per hour?
For 15.
That's what I'm saying. It's per unit, right?
I can give you the exact.
You don't need to. The question is more, and I think we might have talked about this a little bit at the first meeting, how much of that actually becomes the RN's salary versus this is what DHS pays and there's some portion of it that goes to the agency. What percentage goes to the salary of the RN or the LPN generally?
Well, we'll default to our presenter first.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we have no data that shows us what the wages are. Okay. We only have the rate that we pay to the providers. So that would be up to the individual provider to determine what their rate is. I mean, what their wage is, excuse me.
Sorry, I'll get a hang of this. I'm Stacey Voglich, Mr. Chair. Some of my comments are based on my experience as both a parent who writes the support plan for her kiddo, plus I'm a support planner, so I write nursing plans, you know, the waiver plans for other families. So I also have to be realistic with my clients and telling them that there's a shortage of staff, and then their wages are low. And then I get creative with what we can do under waivers on bonuses and stuff like that, which can help but doesn't solve all this problem. Typically speaking, the gap between their salary and what the Medicare reimbursement rate averages about $10. And for the $10 per hour, that means the nursing agencies have to, you know, take care of all that other issues, their payroll people, the accounting. You get the idea. It's a very short amount of margin, very small margin.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Just a hypothetical question, Mr. Chair. Nothing's ever hypothetical, but if you take that same complex care nurse and that person is working at one of our HMO facilities, let's say they're in a clinic, and it's a nurse and a nurse, an RN and an RN, same kind of thing, and they're providing services to folks that were perhaps getting their assistance through medical assistance or whatever, does the same reimbursement rate apply to the clinic and the hospital as it does to the home health agency?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, no.
It doesn't. So I knew that. So do you know offhand, Heidi, what the, because I thought there was a huge gap between the reimbursement side between those that are working in the box stores and those that are working in the homes. Do you know off the top of your head what that number is?
I don't know.
So, Mr. Chair, if we could have that just as something for us to, you know, look over and look at, where's our pediatric home? Cameo is here. There. Judy, yes. Can you answer that question?
I can tell you that the agencies determine the wages that they pay their nurses, their RNs, and their LPNs. So, as does a hospital or a clinic determine the wages, and they have a matrix that they use based on education, experience, and background. So the wages vary. I can tell you at Pediatric Home Service, our average wage for the RN is just short of $30 an hour. If you look at the wages across the state, for home care or home health nurses, they usually run somewhere in the vicinity of $27 an hour. And we do a retention bonus, so that's reflective of the additional $3 an hour.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, that's good. My question, and thanks, Judy, is on the reimbursement. Do you know what the reimbursement? There's a variance in the reimbursement.
If you look at a complex, so most of our cases are complex.
Yep.
So we have a smaller population because we're pediatrics. So the reimbursement from the state of Minnesota for a complex RN is about $44 an hour.
Mr. Chair, but there is a difference between if that RN was working, the reimbursement rate be it in a clinic versus being it at home,
yes,
there's a difference, and we don't know those numbers, correct, unless you do
know
those numbers?
Well, I can tell
numbers.
You at the hospital, if you look at the wages for hospital nurses in, like their intensive care units, their wages are somewhere in the vicinity of $38 to $45 an hour. It just depends on weekends, differentials, nights, what shifts they work. So it's a fairly significant difference, but of course hospitals are paid in a different way and different methodology used than home care. And I think the legislature made some accommodation for long-term care workers back several years ago. So there's a little bit of a difference between home care and home health and long-term care facilities, not as dramatic as there is for hospitals.
Well, and Senator Hoffman, you and I have been talking about this issue for quite a while, and if, you know, we unfortunately within how we put together budgets within our biennial budget process, we're not allowed to capture potential savings in some of these changes, but we've talked about a complex RN rate, especially when you think about the idea of increasing reimbursement rates for a pediatric intensive care population that's stable on a vent. They don't need to be in a hospital. They can be at home with their family. And not only is it best for the family, not only is it best for the kiddo, but if you do the basic math, it saves the state of Minnesota money by getting those kids out of the hospital and into the home. It's best for kids, it's best for family, and financially it makes the most sense. And it's something that we've been working on.
I think it extends across the board, not just to the kids. I mean, I think when we look at it from the standpoint of the aging population, the longer we can keep them in their homes, and first of all, it's a better quality of life, no question. Secondly, the ultimate cost is going to be lower because you don't have the capital investment that you have to have in a facility. And there's going to be some economies there because the person living in that home with that person, or the relative or the friend that comes in, is going to provide some service that's going to alleviate some of the necessity for that home care provider to actually provide. So, I mean, I think it's all the way around, not only from a pediatric standpoint, but from the other end of the scale. We need this is something that is why I'm committed to try and figure out a way to keep people in their homes as we go forward.
So, Senator Hoffman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jerry, you bring up an interesting dilemma. There's two points then. Number one, there's the reimbursement side is different between the clinic, but anecdotally, talk to Susan Wingert and those that are doing that pediatric type, you know, their nurses are walking across the street and they're getting the wages that Judy just exposed right there. So we have a huge, huge gap. And when you looked at those, the last data that was there from the LPN, that shrinking workforce, wow. You know, it's. I think those we need to bring those into perspective as well. And then Terry's got something. So,
Ms. Erdman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Heidi, do you guys have any information about where we rank? So, like, I was just looking at, you know, what this work group was supposed to come up with, and one of them was that we were supposed to determine, like, kind of where Minnesota's national ranking is on wages for home health care. And I was wondering if you guys would have that information, or where would we get that?
Mr. Chair, we don't have information on
other
states. DHS.
Okay.
We could look at other states and compare rates that we pay for home care nursing. We could do that.
Okay. But thank you.
It seems to me, I come from the business sector, that, and in fact used to work in human resources in terms of actually determining wages across multiple states. I work for a major corporation, and that data is available. And we should be able to find some place where that data is collected. If not the Bureau of Labor Standards, then possibly from some other sources that involve themselves in the home care and nursing care arena. And I would think that would be something that would be important to get if we can.
Yeah. No, I agree. Mr. Tollefson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious if we have any information on, I was interested to hear that $10 per hour average that goes towards administrative expenses for the reimbursement or whatever that might be. Do we have more information on that rate? Like with insurance, for example, we hear what the what they call medical loss ratio is each year. Is there a similar data point that we have for home care agencies on what goes to actual care versus what goes to administrative expenses?
Mr. Chair, we do not have that information for home care nursing. There are some of our services, such as the disability waiver rates, where we do have more of that information, but we would not have that for home care nursing.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be helpful information. Just if we're talking about not having enough money to pay nurses, that $10 an hour is very interesting to me in terms of a what administrative expenses are actually needed and whether we're achieving efficiency with that number.
Yeah, oh, I think that's a good point.
Thank you. I think there's probably only anecdotal information on that because every agency determines the level of training they deliver or provide for those nurses that are going into the homes to care for those. So the agency has the responsibility to train. It's not like you can go to school, get your RN, and then just be fully able to function in any environment or capacity. There's a certain level of training. So in the home care environment, it is dependent on the circumstances of the particular client. And so there's a specific amount of training, and that's agency dependent. So it varies widely across the state. We don't have, I know the Minnesota Home Care Association does not have the specific details in terms of that, but it would be interesting to collect some of that information for those agencies.
Yeah.
Can you help me, sorry, Mr. Chairman, when you are required to do training for your staff by the state, my understanding is that, you know, you're pulling your nursing staff from their positions within their home care families, and then you can't get reimbursement when you're doing the training. So there's a lot of areas where they're absorbing costs and not getting reimbursed. Can you comment?
That
is correct. There is no specific payment for any training. So if you are providing training before a client goes home, you're absorbing the cost of all of that training. So once the client is home and receiving services is when you get paid for the services you're providing. So as an example, a complex RN, you would be receiving $44 an hour. And so if you're paying your nurses, let's say, $30 an hour, you have a $10 difference per hour. So, but you're also providing extensive training for those nurses. Now, I can't speak to all clients in the home care setting and how much training they get, but I can certainly speak about training for our particular agency. But, again, it's just one agency. It's probably not going to speak to the industry as a whole.
Mr. Chair, you know, when you look at that, the wages and taxes, you know, you take the bottom line, 13%, and then overhead costs are anywhere from 20 to 40%, yeah, depending upon, you know, where you're at, which gives you X. So Y equals X. And I would, my assumption then would be that a privately owned provider is going to be different than a nonprofit provider as far as how they see the X, correct?
I'm assuming,
you would assume that. But is there any way, I know, how much latitude do we have as legislators or we have as a body to look into if you're giving somebody a reimbursement and that is the Y or the X, and is there any way that you could get the data, or is there language that's needed so we could get the Y so there's a transparency about how that money is being utilized? And I'm not looking for fraud, waste, and abuse, Heidi. But it's just, it dawns on me that there's these complex levels of service providers, and we're all asking the same question. How are we going to get to covering the gap in payment, the gap in the workforce shortage, right, which then gets gap in services? Is there any mechanism now that DHS has to look at, especially because when you look at DWRS or rate methodology, we're talking about $3 to $5 billion a year of services that the feds give to us and we disperse out. We have some kind of range of looking at how that money's being spent, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, so we did just recently get statutory authority for disability waiver rate system to collect information from providers on where they're spending the rate that we're giving them.
But that's only within DWR.
I think that's helpful.
That's very helpful, Mr. Chair. Might be something to look into.
No, I think that's very helpful. Ms. Alder, before we move on, I just want to go back to your chart that you passed out. And if we go over to the far side, you know, I see the 75% of filled units from allocated, from authorized to actually filled. And I see, you know, 73.4%. The budgetary numbers on the far right, are those baked into the forecast? Or how's that money laid out? Because I guess as I'm looking at all this and we're trying to debate whether or not there's really a workforce shortage, the Department of Human Services has identified $169 million of need. They delivered $124 million with a gap of 27%. Why? And so I think that's the big question. And so is that being tracked in the forecast, or where is that money traveling through that we could budget such a huge amount of money, come in 27% below budget in what we deliver, and alarm bells aren't going off?
Mr. Chair, the forecast is based on trends, and so if this has been the trend that this is the amount paid, that's what it's based on, is the amount paid, not the amount authorized. But I can get some more information for you about how that forecast is calculated.
Yeah, I think that would be really helpful,
Mr. Chair.
For this group. Senator,
I think, however, you've really focused on a point here. And that is that in the testimony that we took in the HS reform in the Senate, we found this tremendous amount of unfilled but authorized units. And the question that I've had all along is, okay, first of all, how did we determine that we should authorize those units? If we found that there was a need, and in other words, there was a live, breathing body out there that was supposed to receive services, and we authorize them to receive the service, and then obviously 27% of those people who were authorized and had a need, that service went unfilled. To me, that just raises a huge question. Number one, why? And number two, what is happening to that person? Are they going to the emergency room? What are they doing? And I think this is, I want to focus us back in on this. We can talk numbers all day, but I'm talking about the real true factual impact of what's going on here. And that's, I guess, the question I'm trying to get at is, we have these unfilled hours. What's happening to the people that those hours represent?
Ms. Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In working with over 50 to 60 clients, and I work with and talk to moms of complex kids because that's what my child is, all throughout the state, the farther out you go from the metro, the less staff there are to find. And then in metro, they're competing. A lot of times you get young nurses that will start in home care to get their feet wet, get the lower wage, and then they get a year or two in, and boom, they're gone to the hospitals because that's where the money is and the bennies are. The bennies are what kill the home care industry. It's just a fact, even with health insurance. All the other 401k, you know, vacation, all of that. I know of families near the Brainerd area that have been waiting 3 years to get nursing. And, of course, there's some percentage of this where the kiddo is in the hospital or the patient is in the hospital, so the fund's a different source. Okay. So that's a piece of your 27%. But it's truly we just can't find the staff. And it's a unique world. It's not like the hospital where you get whatever nurse it comes into your room in your home, it can take a while to find a good fit. And if there aren't that many to choose from, some families would rather do all the care themselves. And I do know moms who have been doing it all alone, 24/7. These are kids who don't sleep regular and or need meds all night long and everything else for years. And I do worry about their burnout just as much as the staff shortage. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, Judy.
And thank you, Stacy. I think also, and again, our population is unique, so it's complex children. So there are planned and unplanned hospitalizations that do account for some of those differences. I can tell you our personal statistics for staffing. We have the hours allocated, and we staff at 90%. So we miss 10% of the shifts, not because we don't want to provide those shifts, but because we don't have adequate nursing coverage for those cases at that time.
Ms. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that was kind of one of my, thoughts around this is that I'm wondering, it's not 27% of the people not getting services. There's 27% of the units not being filled, mm-hmm. right, billable units. And so I was, I think it would be good to maybe see if we could do a breakdown of it. Does that mean that out of, 100 people, 18% of them didn't get, 12% of theirs met? Like, I'm just trying to think of, the mm-hmm. average, and if that's broken down by mm-hmm. state or county, because 27% sounds terrifying, and I'm not saying that we don't have a workforce shortage, but is it, some of them are missing 8% in the metro, of their units of care, and out in the rural, they're missing more. So I'm just wondering if that type of data is anywhere.
Ms. Vogel.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the home care agencies are supposed to report either to DHS or Department of Health when they underfill the client's units. Because we get a report that you're authorized for, 60 hours and you only get 40 or 45. Personally, our family gets that. So I would think that they are capturing the data, and you're looking mm-hmm. at me like you've never heard of that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've seen it. Mr. Chair, we can look and see if we can get that information broken out by county. I don't believe we get reports from the agencies, but we have the data that shows what's been authorized right. and what's been paid.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just as a follow-up, I think that we know there's a shortage. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think anybody in here disagrees that there's a shortage. I think the question is, number one, how bad is it? And number two, where is it? Mm-hmm. I mean, if we're having unfilled units, but some of that stuff that's unfilled is maybe something that could be served by other than RNs or LPNs, or it is being served by someone who is not an RN or an LPN, and therefore we're in the same, the net result is the same, that you have these services that are being provided, and they're not being provided by the RN or the LPN. And that raises the issue, okay, are we identifying the services correctly as what is needed to be provided, and without having to take away from anyone, if we have a way that we can actually augment, and I'm thinking especially from the standpoint of the satisfaction of the people working in the area, which to me, we don't have enough money, folks, face it. Right now, the way the system works, we don't have enough money to pay what we would like to be able to pay. So in any position, you want to provide something in addition to pay that can incentivize people to get into the area. And so if we're looking at specific areas that we can provide some kind of different incentive, we need to identify that. And I think this information, of these raw numbers, as you say, are kind of scary when you talk about 27%. But maybe there's something that is manageable in there, and that's why I think it's just important that we do that.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think that and kind of the acceptance of the shortage, and then kind of identifying the information from the state demographer around the idea of 21,000 additional nursing positions. Mm-hmm. Does anybody know how many nursing students the state of Minnesota graduates per year?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Shirley Brecken with the Board of Nursing. We license new licenses approximately 8,000 RNs a year, and probably about 1,500 to 1,750 LPNs a year.
What was that second number for the LPNs?
I have to verify it, Senator.
I'm sorry.
But it's less than 2,000, but it's right between 1,500 and 2,000.
And so I look at that going out, and that's where I get concerned, is the demand is just going gangbusters.
Yeah.
Ms. Brecken.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the state of Minnesota has traditionally been an exporter of nurses. In other words, we educate generally more nurses, you know, that go elsewhere to work. A lot of it has to do with what you identified earlier. You know, if you're 22 years old and you're a college grad and you've been living in Minnesota all your life, you maybe want to look at California or Hawaii or someplace else. So that is not the only reason. I mean, it really has to do a lot of times with just mobility of the population. But Minnesota has traditionally been an exporter. In other words, we graduate more than remain in the state.
Ms. Vaughn.
Mr. Chairman, it does look like our language of our committee allows us to look at trying to identify other professionals that might help us broaden that gap. And I know I was having a great conversation with this lady next to me about potentially looking at could we allow some of the cares to be done by certified medical assistants, perhaps?
Yeah, and I think as we go back to the genesis of the legislation and how we move forward, I think one of the things that Senator Ralph and I were committed to, not just last session, but historically, is how do we meet the need? How do we meet the growing healthcare need? And how do we innovate our workforce to meet future needs? And I think that's something that we've discussed within the legislative session. I think that's one of the things that this workforce shortage work group will be digging into. And I think there are huge opportunities if we look at skill sets that traditionally were having filled by LPNs and RNs in the home care setting, what those specific skills are and what other options are for folks to deliver those skills that could help us look at workplace shortage, look at training requirements, and look at kind of restrictions within just the demand versus the future supply. Before we move on with that, I want to – oh, Mr.
May I give you a correction? I had shot an email to our staff. I was pretty much spot on about the registered nurses. In 2017, we licensed 7,718, so about 8,000 registered nurses. We licensed 1,350 LPNs.
Okay. Thank you so much.
That's calendar year.
Okay, perfect. Thank you for that information. I want to turn it over to Ms. Hamilton for any closing remarks, and then I want to move on to the Department of Health. Be conscientious of everyone's time. I got a text message from my wife. The roads are getting yucky, so I want to stay on schedule here.
Mr. Chair, in that vein, I don't have any additional comments to make. I'll let the committee move along to the next topic.
Thank you for your information. I know we've asked for some additional information, and to the best ability of the department to forward that along, that would be very helpful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next up, we have Ms. Moby from the Department of Health.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the work group, my name is Nithika Moebi. I'm with the Department of Health, Office of Growth and Primary Care.
I have the fun job of going last, and I understand I'm standing between you and the road, so I'll make it quick. I'll offer a few highlights about, we've heard about the labor market shortages and the trends that we're seeing from the demographer's office. We've heard a little bit about the median wages that RNs and LPNs are being paid, and we've also heard a little bit about the utilization that we're seeing. I'm going to provide some more information about the size of the RN and LPN workforce that you were just talking about, and some policy areas that where interventions can be targeted to shore up some of these shortages. So before I begin, Judy, I remembered your question about just kind of the definitional ambiguity that has been around the concept of home health workforce. And just to scope out our discussions, for the purposes of today, we're considering home health workers as part of a contingent of the director's workforce, which includes PCAs, home health aides, orderlies, attendants, CNAs, as well as some of the other licensed healthcare workforce that often need to go into the home health settings to provide care. And that includes, for instance, for here, it includes LPNs and RNs. And that's going to be the focus of our presentation today from the Department of Health. I would be remiss if I don't acknowledge my colleagues at the Board of Nursing, without whose partnership we wouldn't have the data that I'm able to present to you today. I wouldn't be able to harness the intelligence to inform your policymaking. So thank you, Shirley, for your effort in helping us collect these data. So we're going to be responsive specifically to this charge, and we'll help quantify the current shortages and projections around the LPN and RN workforce that work in the home healthcare setting. And a little bit about the mechanics of how we collect the data. At the time of license renewal, all licensed professionals, including LPNs and RNs, when they are renewing their license online, they are requested to complete a Department of Health workforce survey that asks them information around, you know, where they work, how long they tend to practice, their race and ethnic demographic information, their practice plans, their cultural competency preparedness, et cetera. So that's the information that we're going to harness and hopefully feed back to you. And the respondents that we have selected that are part of this information group are the ones that have selected on our survey that they work in a home healthcare agency setting. That's where they spend their primary time. So that's the subset of the information that we'll have. So going back to the conversation that was just happening, this is the size and what is happening to the trend of the LPN workforce in our state. Looking back 10 years, this is partial 2017 data, so we don't have all year 2017 data, but you can start to see that there's a decline in the number of licensees that are being being driven in Minnesota. We start to see the decline right around 2010, and it's been sort of a 1 to 2 percentage points since then. On the other hand, the RN workforce is climbing. Again, we see that the uptick really started in 2010, and there have been gains in the labor market workforce since then. Here's a number on the size of the workforce that select, again, going back to a survey, these are the numbers that selected that they work in the home health agency. And you can see that LPNs, just 8% of all licensed LPNs that responded work in the sector, compared to 5% of the RNs. So we are talking about a small but mighty subset of the workforce. Both LPN and RNs, on average, they work about 33 and 40 hours per week, respectively, in this sector, and they stay an average of 5 years in the sector. Home health LPNs tend to be a bit older compared to all LPNs in the workforce, so this has implications for exits, retirements, burnouts. Home health RNs tend to be slightly better, evenly distributed across the age profile. About 52% of the home health RNs are older compared to 50% of the entire RN workforce. This should not be surprising. The nursing workforce is predominantly white. However, when we look at all of our licensed providers, the LPNs are the most diverse of the entire healthcare workforce. That has implications for cultural competency, delivery of healthcare. Among the home health LPNs, they are a little more diverse compared to the larger LPN population. 10% of them are black compared to 5% of the LPN workforce. This trend is sort of similar for RNs as well. It's a predominantly white profession, slightly less African-American slash black slash, black or African-American or African participants, 5% compared to 3% RN population overall. This is a chart that I want to spend a little bit of time on. Traditionally, there's always been the assumption that it's the institutionalized elderly that are the biggest utilizers of these long-term support care services, But this chart kind of emphasizes that there's a large part of the community that is resides in community settings, and it is more than just the elderly. For instance, if you look at the children that are in community settings along with the working age population that is in community settings, and if you just kind of squint your eyes and add the bars, they're a little taller than the bar for the elderly in the community settings. So it's not just the elderly that are using these services, but it is people in community settings, including children and working age adults. This has implications for reimbursement.
Excuse me, do we have similar data for Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Senator Ralph, we do not. This is a U.S. number that I'm pulling from the 2010 census, so we do not have comparable data for Minnesota. What we do have, and this is just a theoretical exploration we wanted to see, if we just looked at the population that's 65 years and older and see how they are spread across the state, and then we wanted to look at what the LP and RN distribution is across the state, that we've tried to do, and that's right here. And you'll see there's a maldistribution of LPNs and RNs in certain parts of the region, the state. For instance, in Northeast, there's a larger swath of population that's older compared to the LPNs and RNs that are available in that region of the state. Similarly, in Southeast, despite the male effect, including the Southwest. So while we don't have those kinds of data available, this just gives an idea of the male distribution of these nursing services across the state compared to population 65 and older. We have no way of discerning if this population is in residence or in institutional settings. This is just a flavor for what the states looked like. In the interest of time, I'm going to quickly just go over to my summary slide, then I can deep dive into any one of these. So you'll see here the home health LPNs tend to be older compared to the home health RNs, 48 years compared to 45 years. Home health LPNs, just 50% intend to work in the home health field for 10 years or more compared to 65% of home health RNs. And I'm looking at the first column and the third column and just comparing that to give us some quick differences. Again, it's a predominantly white profession, but there's more diversity among home health LPNs than home health RNs. I was interested and intrigued to learn that we are a net exporter of nursing professions, but we are a pretty good source of educating our own. For instance, 89% of all home health LPNs say that they got their diploma from Minnesota, and 79% say of our home health RNs say they got their associate's degree from Minnesota. Overall career satisfaction, surprisingly, they seem to be pretty satisfied. Home health RNs and LPNs, we didn't see a difference between the home health contingent and the larger RN and the LPN contingent. And we also asked them specifically some question on how they learned to work in interdisciplinary teams and where did they best prepare, where did they best feel they get their cultural competency preparation from. And on both those factors, they feel like they learn best on the job. And we think those are important factors as we think about delivering competent care and team care, which is a big part of how healthcare is delivered today. I want to talk a little bit about the sources of satisfaction that home health LPNs and RNs tell us about, and it's in front of you. They love to work with the elderly. They love caring for the residents. The one-on-one relationship with their clients gives them satisfaction. The profession's rewarding. They love the fact that they can help people stay out of the hospital and stay in their homes. The sources of dissatisfaction should not be surprising here. Turnover, pressure, low wages, benefits, physically demanding work, lack of career laddering. There's a stigma around this job not being very professionally satisfying. And so these are really the policy lever, or the areas where I think policy levers can be engaged to help uplift this population. With that, I'm going to close my comments. There are about a dozen slides that I did not go over, but they really are summarized over here. But if there's interest, I'm happy to go over those as well.
I think we got it.
It should be
not in our.
Oh, we did not get. Can you?
I will go ahead and email this out as soon as I get back to my desk. We'll send this slideshow out. I just did not receive this until just before the committee hearing. Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And did your work just look at it, I'm seeing the, what was the age range of those those that were getting services in their homes? Was it predominantly elderly in this case?
So in our data, we have no way of discerning who the client population is. We don't know if they're the elderly or children. This is really a provider survey. So we get this information from the licensed RNs and LPNs, and they tell us they're working in home health settings. We don't ask them who they're serving and where they're serving them.
Okay. So, and Mr. Chair, just to follow, it was interesting because just the anecdotal comments were seemed to me more trending to elderly population than they would, knowing that in Minnesota, one in five youth have a special health care need, and you're looking at some numbers, and I'm going to get back to the pediatric folks. And we also know, was any of that information surrounded by through your Title V public health grants, any of the deliverables that are assumed within that? Because we know in order to get the Title V public health grant money from the feds, you know you have to include 33% has to be children and youth with special health care needs. So is any of that data also within your information?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, unfortunately, no. We do not have that data as part of this presentation. And I don't know if the department has that data, but I can check.
And Mr. Chair and members, this goes back to the information the demographer put up. I'm just going to bring us back. As our aging population increases, we also look at, you know, we have the special needs population is also widening because of the fact that it is. I mean, we had better outs than that, but it blows me away that, you know, we know that some of our deliverables that we have within the 18 health indicators federally or the 12 or maybe the opposite 12 federal, 18 Minnesota, and regarding to Title V public health services, you know, a third of that has to go toward children and youth with special health care needs. So I think this is great information, but there's still some missing gaps there, just like we pointed within the demographer. So that all needs to be taken into consideration, even as we talk about looking at potentially the workforce shortage within working with home health agencies or home care within our population of youth, and I can't get my hands around that right now. But I'm missing some information here, and I wish I had it.
And I think, Senator Hoffman, I appreciate those comments. And I think from the presentations that we've had today, I think it's interesting for every bit of info and data we get, it kind of, in some ways, in some aspects, asks new
more
questions.
Doors, yeah.
Yeah, it does. I appreciate Ms. Moebius' presentation and the cooperation we've had from Deed and the demographer's office, the Department of Health, and the Department of Human Services have been really helpful as we've put this together, and so thank you very much. Does anybody have any other questions for
Zaroff? I just have one question or comment, and this is for any of the people that have provided us with statistics and also maybe the nursing. We've been talking about the aging of our population, and there was some discussion about retirements and people leaving the nursing profession, but I am wondering if we could drill down a little more on that. Because I think as we go forward, if you look at just the overall age of the population and then the age of the nursing population, that I think we may have something that we need to build into the thinking that we are, I am assuming, just because of age, going to be losing an increasing number of people in that workforce. And that I think that's something we also should take a look at, because I think that might also change some of our thinking about how we go forward with this. Because if we're losing people at a greater rate than we're replacing them, we have a major problem. And so I think that's something that we should look at and drill down on.
Mr. Chair, can I just make a quick comment on the slide that I just brought up? Senator Ruff, to your point, you're right. We have, you know, speaking of the LPN workforce, we know that just 50% of the LPN workforce plans to stay in this sector and wants to exit within 10 years. And when we ask them why they want to exit, 80% of them tell us they want to exit because they want to become RNs.
They want to become, I'm sorry?
RNs, to become registered nurses. So we have this information from them. That's why we're seeing a contraction. One of the big reasons why we're seeing a contraction in this workforce and why this trend line is pointing the way it is is because they're leaving to get a better mm-hmm. degree.
And well, but I mean, I'm talking about the overall nursing, right. not just LPNs.
Mm-hmm. Judy Giel with the Minnesota Home Care Association, and I have some information from Modern Healthcare. July 2017 Health Resources and Services Administration report that 70,000 nurses are retiring annually. This is national, so by 2030, almost a million nurses will retire and leave the workforce. And 64,000 nurses are turned away from nursing programs annually. So there's more retiring, and then 64,000 people who are applying aren't able to get into the nursing schools.
And here's your question. Here's a little bit of information to your question on the exits from the RN and LPN workforce. So retirement is certainly a big part of it. 76% of the RNs are leaving because of that. And 16% are working in another state, so that is the export that we're doing and losing that. But I'm looking at the 31% that's blue that's saying other, and 80% of that are saying they want to become RNs. Mm-hmm. And some are wanting to change their profession, so there is some dissatisfaction there too.
Mr. Chair, just follow up on that. The other thing that, you know, it really is the LPNs primarily, most of the time it's the wage. Mm-hmm. One of the things that, you know, very often you look at mobility, you know, move from nursing assistant to LPN to RN to, you know, to graduate work. When you ask nursing assistants and long-term care, are you planning on progressing your education? There is a significant population that says, no, I'm not going to become an LPN. I make more money as an experienced nursing assistant than I would make as an LPN.
Mr. Tollefson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree that you know, nursing is a tremendous profession in the sense of growth, you know, that you can start at that level, go up to LPN and then to RN, and it's a great, you know, career path in that sense. And I'm encouraged by the estimate that we received that there would be 21,000 openings for RNs or between 2014 and 2024. And as Ms. Brecken said, if we graduate 8,000 nurses a year, we'd be at 80,000 if that rate holds the same over that 10-year period. So we should be, so far we're not at a shortage of nursing in terms of actually graduated, you know, and qualified nurses. And so that if that rate continues, we'll be, you know, well into the future, able to provide the nurses that we have. However, is there some disagreement there?
I think that number was for RN.
Right.
Right?
So, yeah.
But that's still with the LPN and...
And I'm looking at the RN projected growth. You're talking about the LPN
right.
growth. Okay, that's fair. Yeah, that's fair.
People leaving just as much as they're probably were graduating.
Right. Well, no, that was 6,700 openings between that time period and 2,100,000 when you consider those leaving the workforce, but for RNs, to your point. But the other question I wanted to raise just before we left, because I'm really you know, intrigued by what you and Senator Ralph said earlier about this rate of fulfilled, you know, authorized versus filled, you know, units. And I think just for our next meeting, are we having another meeting? For our next meeting, it would be really interesting to hear from DHS fiscal analysts or, you know, what, because I think, I mean, if you look at the $170 million that's there versus the $125 million that was actually used, there is plenty of money there, $45 million. I just wonder if it's there's a way to distribute that differently, you know, for authorized hours and if this...
I don't know if the money's there.
No. Because I think there's budget for that, and then only what's paid out.
Correct? Well, this is based on projections, right?
But the projections are based on what's paid out.
And I think
based
that's
on the 75% number, I believe.
And so that was my
that was my question.
Yeah, and Mr. Thompson, I think that goes back to an earlier question that I had asked about how come we don't see this gap on the forecast, and from the department, the answer was because the forecast is based on historically what's been paid out, and historically what's been paid out, according to the testifier, was in that 74 to 75% range. And so although in theory the units allocated are 27% higher than what's been claimed. Historically, what's been paid out is keeping that trend line at the 73 to 75%. But I think to Senator Ralph's point to that is I want to make sure that we are meeting the need of the right patients at the right point in time for the right care provided in the right interventions. And if, as a system, we're identifying a 27% gap in units authorized versus units delivered, where is that? How is that gap impacting actual people? And is it moms that are working 72 hours straight because nursing care just didn't show up, and so they're up with their child or they're up with their loved one? And so I think that's the question, and how we dig into that a little bit deeper. And then if I may, one step further, figure out as we look forward, policy-wise, what is the best, most efficient way to fill that gap? I think Ms. Vogel has a comment, and then I think we have a few other comments as well.
Thank you, Chairman. I just forgot to mention earlier that this is to your point of authorized versus spent. I work with clients who are on the CDCS waivers, you know, and that budget, even if you're at the top, even if you're on the right budget, which is a big if, and you got a good budget, that budget still will not cover often as many units are authorized. And that's pretty much how the CDCS system was built, right? You get 30% less if you go on CDCS. So I don't know how that factors into your authorized versus paid, but it is a little piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, just a couple questions. Just one thing, looking to the statute, which I know we need to talk about in terms of timeline and some other things, but when I look at it, it's really focused on low-complexity services, right, and the workforce that is providing these low-complexity services. So when I go back to this handout, we keep talking about the 27%, but when you look at the regular versus the complex, so I assume regular is low-complexity here, it's actually around an average of 65% that is used rather than authorized, right? So it's actually a bigger issue. Yeah. If that is an indicator of the problem, and granted we don't know why, the gap is even larger in the low complexity. So I would suggest that we maybe focus there, which is where the spirit of the statute is.
I think that's an excellent point.
But the other thing that comes to mind is, just as we think about how to move forward, I hear a lot of anecdotal evidence about shortages, but there's not a lot of data that we have. And I'd suggest that maybe one of the recommendations that might need to come out of here is about additional data that we're going to need to collect. It doesn't address the immediate problem, but as we think about both shorter-term and longer-term issues, there is additional data that would help us to answer some of these questions that just does not exist right now, that DHS may be able to collect, or that home care agencies or the associations may be collect and be able to collect in the future, and we have to think about that.
So. Well, I think that's an excellent point. Ms. Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just hoping that we really can dig down into the 27% a little bit more, just because I don't think that number, while, you know, 27% of unused units, that's, you know, alarming. I just don't think we know if that is 3% of the folks who are receiving care aren't getting 8% of their service, you know, their units. So, I mean, that's a different dramatic, that tells a different story. Mm-hmm. And so I think that if we can get more information around that, it would be much more helpful for all of us.
Yes.
Just to repeat what Heidi said earlier, I mean, I agree that we'd like to get more information. It is anecdotal. We also hear from families that don't want staff in their homes overnight, and they're choosing not to have staffing. So it's just something that we just don't have. We know that there's hospitalizations as well, planned and unplanned, as you said earlier. And we're not denying that we acknowledge that we believe there's a shortage, but we're just trying to be careful about how we present this data.
Sure. Yep, I think that's an excellent point.
Can I add to your...
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. So when I heard the 65%, Mr. Chair, my memory bank went to, there was a certain waiting list that Minnesota had for kids receiving waivered services, and we had the same argument about what was authorized and what wasn't used. And regardless, you worked on it in the House. I worked on it in the Senate. And Heidi, if we could get somebody from the department, I hope this is not the same argument or the same discussion, because if that's the case, then you know, we know what happened with that discussion of the waiting list. There was a certified class action lawsuit that was filed. We had to do something legislatively to say that you will spend the authorized money, and the argument was, well, it's not real money, it's on the formulary, but it's not, it's authorized, it's not within the budget. Everybody got into these semantical conversations, but yet what was really missing was the fact that kids with youth with special health care needs weren't getting the services they ever needed. I think we found an answer to that, Nick, right? I mean, there was deep discussion on it. I hope this isn't the same. I'm getting all red here. So my left brain's kicking in saying, why? My right brain's kicking in saying, ouch. I mean, is there, there would be some good, I think we need to keep having that conversation, because if it clearly is real money or not real money, the fact is if it's something that's being unused, right, why is it being unused, left brain? Right brain saying, you know, I don't feel good about it. So help me understand the gap there. I mean, does that make sense?
Mr. Chair, another point that I want to remind people that Heidi mentioned in terms of how the services are authorized, agencies have a great deal of flexibility in their service authorization, and they may choose to send RNs out instead of an LPN for various reasons. They might have more RNs to staff a child or a person with a disability or a senior, and they also may feel that the person is more complex, and although they had LPN units authorized, they choose to move those services around and utilize RNs. So that is one factor that comes into play, which is why we wanted to focus on the far right column when we did present this data, but it is something to take a look at.
I think just as a follow-up to that what we really need to do, and you raised a very good point, that what percentage of that percentage is complex, what percentage is non-complex, I think that's something we haven't focused on as much, because I think in terms of the immediacy and the immediate relief that we can provide, the better handle we have on what areas there are that non-complex and areas where we can actually focus on to provide a quicker fix, if you wish, that's something I think we need to know. And so I really do, what I'm hearing here is kind of an overall theme is, as the little robot said, need more input. We definitely have to get, I think, a little bit more specific in the data that we've got.
I think it would be helpful to at least have a regional breakdown, and then there might be a possibility of matching some of the regional service utilization information with what we do know about workforce availability by region. It could be a start, at least.
Yeah. No, I think that's an excellent point. I would be remiss if I didn't point out that in 5 days, the statutory authorization of the Workforce Shortage Working Group expires. That being said, my hope is that we can... in our work with the departments, that we can put something out and come together one more time. And if someone's going to have a big problem with it, I guess we can talk. But I think we had a pause within there because of... Watch me. It's going to get crazy.
I get the gavel next, too, so...
Well, who knows what's going to happen? But it would be... And so that being said, it wouldn't be under my purview to call it. But I think we're starting to get some information to dig into this. we have some remaining charges for this group to come together and identify. And my hope is that prior to session beginning, we're able to come together one more time to try to do that. And to that end, I'll turn it over to Senator Ralph for any closing remarks that he might have.
I think just simply that the progress to date is significant in that we have actually been able to drill down on the areas that we need data on to look at. And I think that of itself, we started out with this kind of broad idea that, gee, we've got some unmet needs and maybe here's a way to do it in a very specific concept in the original language of the statute, and have taken and now I think found a way to at least get a handle on this more than a solution yet. I think we're still quite a ways from solutions, but I think we by drilling down on this information that we've got, we're much better equipped to be able to look at where solutions may lie. And I think that the focus of the next meeting, whether it be authorized or not, would be to, first of all, if we've got more specific information, to talk about that, and then maybe use that as a planning tool for the next stage. And I'm sure that legislatively we can deal with some of this as we go forward in this session. So that would be my kind of closing remarks and guidance as we go forward.
Okay. One more question. So yeah. It sounds like we're saying we're going to have a rogue meeting at some point.
Well, we don't have to call it that.
Okay. We're down with the rogue
call
meeting.
Call it what we want.
But are there any of these specific questions that we're being asked to answer that you want to ask any of the agencies to do some homework on and come back to you with? I can think of a couple that might be answerable.
I think the only thing we have to be careful is the authorization in the language of the statute. But the agencies were not being told to go out and create new data.
Mm-hmm.
They were not being told to go out. We were supposed to use the existing information they had. Now, that being said, if the agencies do have or are willing to provide some of that, that would be something that we could hold out as an offer, as a hope to do that.
Senator Ralph, just to let you know that they're not going to be willing unless you ask for options. So you have to ask the agencies for options there, Senator Ralph.
But the point is that I think if in going forward, we do need to be more specific with the agencies in terms of what we're asking them for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I think in the following days, we'll be circling back with specific questions to meet our charges for the work group laid out within statute, and then hopefully come back together one last time. And again, the delay in having this meeting was to an extent out of our control, and on behalf of the legislature, I'll extend my apologies for the delay. And I want to thank the workforce group for your commitment and your help thus far. And with that, we're adjourned.